Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this week's message. My name's Aaron, and I'm on the staff team here at Eastlake. Everything we do around here depends on the generous donations of our local and online community, people just like you, who tune into these messages and see great benefit from living that idea that life is a gift and love is the point. So if you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by going to eastlakecc.com. With that, let's jump into this week's message. Today, we hear from Jason Lewis as he begins our new series, In My Shoes.
Hey, everyone. My name is Jason Lewis. I've been a part of Eastlake for going on 10 plus years now. And I'm kicking off the series, In My Shoes. Throughout this series, you're going to be hearing from a number of BIPOC voices. Today, I want to tell a little bit of my story. More than anything, what I want to do today is try to articulate where you need to be, both mentally and emotionally, to be able to not only process this information that you'll be hearing over the next coming weeks, but to also allow this information to transform you, to educate you, and to move you toward greater action that brings about racial reconciliation and greater racial equity in this country. So I've lived in Washington my entire life. I've lived basically all over the state. My parents moved basically every 3 years. And we lived at different times in really poor areas to quite affluent areas as I got into junior high and high school. And I went from living in areas of great diversity where there were people that looked like me, people from all kinds of BIPOC communities, to living in Woodinville, which is a small suburb outside Seattle, which is almost exclusively white. Throughout that whole time, obviously, it was a journey for me, not only in understanding who I was as a person, but more than anything, how I was going to be viewed and seen in the broader world as I encountered communities that were, and in a state that is primarily white. So the first year I grew up in, I had lots of friends of color, and I didn't necessarily feel out of place. Race wasn't a thing that was brought up or used as a weapon against me amongst my peers as a very young child, because there were so many kids of color, whether they were black or Asian or Latino or Indian or Middle Eastern. I think we all just saw one another as friends. And that's one of the benefits of growing up in a diverse area, is you just come to know people as people. As I got older, what I figured out was that really depends on where you live. And the second I left that area and moved to a more affluent and almost exclusively white area, everything changed for me. I was one of four black kids in my entire high school. I don't mean just in my class. I mean in the entire high school, through every single grade, there was about four, maybe five of us. And almost immediately out of the gate, I was ridiculed because of the color of my skin. Whether I was called derogatory names, whether I was made fun of because I always had this mixture of style that combined urban elements and more prep elements. And this was like 15 years before Kanye West figured that shit out. I was already on that tip. But the fact is that there wasn't really space for me. I remember in high school being grabbed and slammed against a wall, thrown downstairs, the air let out of my tires in my car, to being the kid that was always picked out in class because I looked different. I stood out. I was the only one in 30 kids in that classroom that looked the way I did. So if I talked, you bet your ass they heard me. And they knew to see me as a disruptor. I was seen as a threat. Even though I performed well academically, didn't necessarily have any real change in how I was treated. By the white kids that I was there, I was constantly reminded that I didn't seem black because I didn't say things in a way that they identified as something associated with black culture, or the way I dressed, or the interests I took, whether that was drama. I was always a nerd for literature and stories. I was, in many respects, kind of a bookworm. And that apparently for them and their notion of black culture and black people, it didn't fit. And so that made me a prime target. As I got older, I constantly found that in every space that I went, I'd have to prove myself. I'd have to work twice as hard. I'd have to be twice as reliable. I'd have to communicate so much more completely. I would have to make people feel at ease about the way I looked, about the way I talked, that my appearance more and more as I grew older became a factor in how I would be perceived. And that weight really started around the age of 21 when I became aware that I just was always going to be seen as a threat first. I bought a condo in downtown Kirkland, and I have lived there for quite some time. And then following, after like 6 or 7 years following that, my sister did. And consistently, at least once every 2 weeks, I would be stopped at the elevator and asked which unit I live in, how long have I lived here, who do I know in the building, what I was doing there, and even by people who I'd already had that conversation with. Sometimes 3 and 4 times, these people would assume that I was there to commit a crime, that I was there to harm them, that I was there in some way to destroy their, I don't know, the peace of their life or the order of it. I've been never in trouble in my life, but I have been in handcuffs more than any person that's white that I know that doesn't have any sort of criminal record. I've been pulled over by police more frequently than anybody that I know that's a friend who's white. And even to this day, even though I work in public service, I'll still get pulled over. The assumption will still be that I'm a threat. And I know that some of my friends have been with me in the car when I've been pulled over. And even for them, as white people, it's been a shock to see the way I've been treated. My experience is not uncommon, and it's not super unique and dynamic. I don't have some tremendous tale to tell you of a wrongful jailing or of an altercation with police that ended in gun violence, thankfully. But I do have those experiences with policing authorities, with communities of privilege that are white, and in almost every area of my life, in every single job I've ever had, I have been assumed that I either got opportunities primarily because of the color of my skin, or if I've been skirted over, that there's no possible way that my skin color was a factor. There's really not much space for me to offer my perspective or at times the gifts and the unique parts of who I am that make me, say, qualified to do a thing or capable of doing a thing. My whole life is one of having to prove myself. Prove not only that I'm capable of either doing a task, a job, but also that I'm a kind human being, that I genuinely care for the welfare of my fellow men and women that I work with, see in the world, or know. And that seems to not be going anywhere. In light of recent events, the world is in a state of turmoil, primarily because it once again is having to face down a large, old, and unaddressed wound of racial prejudice, systematic and systemic racism, and a world that is so callous and so deaf to the cries of people of color and black people for decades and decades on end. We now find ourselves in a place where black people are dying. We're capable of filming it unjustly, obviously. We're seeing black people die unjustly, and we're now able to show what has often been said in black communities and households and word of mouth. It's a thing we all grow up knowing. It's a talk we all have. It's a talk we continue to receive from our parents and the people who care for us about our well-being, about how best to not upset the power systems that unfairly judge us and view us as threats. I could talk more about this, but there's so many stories coming. So many perspectives coming. There are so many perspectives to be heard that have so often been silenced, and I don't necessarily need to do that. I think my responsibility here, and I hope you hear this, is to inform you, white people, and the listening body, as to what you will need to understand both in your mind and in your heart to be able to meaningfully engage with this series, with the stories that follow me, and to allow it to actually work on you and inspire you to greater action, greater awareness, and being an actual agent for change and greater racial equality. And so the first thing I want to talk about is the most basic notion, humility. That everything about this is disorienting because you did not grow up in schools that accurately told you American history. You were told that Columbus discovered America. You were told that black people were slaves, and then we fought for our rights, and then we had a drug epidemic. You didn't learn anything about our inventors, about our intellectuals, about the amazing things that we contribute to the world in art, in science, in math, in literature, and in business and commerce. We're commonly seen as either entertainers, criminals, or some relic of the past. And because of that, it's going to require you to have the understanding that what you know is profoundly incomplete. That you will have to listen to the voices that come behind me with the awareness that you frankly do not know the story. If you're interested in what the truth is, it would be important for you to recognize first out of the gate that you probably don't know. You don't know the depth of the pain. You don't know the frequency at which these events occur. You don't know the ways in which it continues to impact communities, families, and individuals all throughout this country and in all sorts of ways, whether someone is wealthy and powerful, whether they are poor and disenfranchised, whether they are educated or find themselves unable to obtain a quality education. These systems work to impact their lives in all sorts of ways, regardless.
Hey everyone, excuse the interruption for a quick minute. My name is Kristen. I'm one of the team members here at Eastlake, and we're so glad that you're joining us today on the podcast. It's been so encouraging for us to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening to these messages and resonating with this idea that we just keep saying over and over again, which is life is a gift and love is the point, and that we are all committed to being a beneficial presence in our own community. So thanks for joining us. I hope that that's resonating with you. It's just really fun for us. So wanted to also say thank you to those of you who contribute. This place, all of these things that we do are happening because of people who make consistent, even just small consistent gifts. It helps us plan. It helps us know that there are really people behind us who want this thing to continue. So thank you to those of you who do that. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that if you find this beneficial in your own life. To make a contribution, it's really easy. You can go to eastlakecc.com and there's a donate button there with all the info. So thanks so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the message.
Biggest thing I want to say too about humility is this recognition that if you would consider yourself a loving, genuine, and a party interested in the most basic notion that life is a gift and love is the point, if you want to fix a problem, you first have to start being able to acknowledge that problem and hear from the parties, open-hearted and open-minded, about what they have to say, even and especially when it makes you feel uncomfortable. You may find yourself feeling guilty or criticized. You may find yourself resistant to this information because it goes against a core teaching maybe at some point you got from your father, your mother, your grandparents, or the water you swam in as a young adult being socialized in the world of America, and how you were socialized and what you were taught about us and about people like us is likely pretty inaccurate. The images you've seen of us portrayed in the media and in films isn't the fullness of who we are. And while we've strove for many years and many generations to try to correct this story, it has never occurred. And not because we haven't produced anything, not because we haven't clearly stated it. It's because we've never had a world humble enough to assume that potentially, or to even beg the question of, could I not be seeing it all? Could I be misunderstanding something? Am I certain that the story I was handed is the story that's true? The second piece I want to talk about is maybe the most important piece, which is embodied belief. My hope is that as you hear these stories and you connect to the pain, to the heartache, to the will and desire of the people who come to share their stories, you will feel a sense to actually do something. To not just feel something, to not just have these lovely feelings that, oh, I so resonate with you, oh, that's so unjust, or that's so deeply unfair, but that you will realize the world only changes because people do shit. So you're going to have to actually do something. If you say you believe a thing, if you say that's who you are, a person who has beliefs, well, those beliefs are only really actually evidenced by the actions you choose to take, which fall in line with those beliefs. The best way I can put it to you is like this. The world is really, really big on this notion right now, that what caring looks like is a social media post, it's a casual conversation at a coffee with some friends or over a light dinner, where the conversation maybe addresses a systemic or a large problem in the world, and everybody shakes hands and nods their head that, yeah, this shit is bad. Yeah, man, I really wish that would change. I can't believe that goes on. And then everybody finishes their meal and drinks their drink and pays their tab and goes the fuck home. And then that stuff just kind of, that ball just keeps rolling. Because nobody at those circumstances is ever going, yeah, no, that's great. We all feel this way. But like, what are we actually going to do about it? Because if we're not going to do about it, let's just be really honest. We don't really care. So like, I would love to say that I really care about starving children in Africa. But right now, if I were to die and you were to examine my life, you would find little to no record that I did anything with my money or my energy to help, aid, protect, or advocate for starving children in Africa. Which means, at a very real level, I don't care. That's hard to hear for some people because we love to believe that we're noble because we have certain thoughts, we have certain feelings. I'm here to say, quite frankly, that's just not how the world works. The only things you are the things you do. And so if you do something, then you should be able to proclaim with reasonable evidence that that's a real belief for you. Why? Because you live it out. Some things, yes, they can be aspirational, right? Being kind. Yes, we can't always be kind, sure. But we should be kind the majority of the time if we believe in the notion of kindness, right? We should be working to that end. And if you would say you're a person who cares about racial equity, racial justice, the end and death of systemic racism, and systematic racism that exists in all levels of society, then you're going to have to actually do some shit. Or otherwise, I'm going to say that there will be no evidence that you really cared and that you should not call yourself an anti-racist or a person who holds those beliefs that all men are created equal and all men deserve an equal shot at a life. This is probably the largest element of cognitive dissonance that exists in American culture today. The idea that you can believe a thing and yet produce no action behind it and somehow call yourself that thing. I'm here to say that's bullshit. I'm here to say that's probably a cancer. And that as you hear these stories, I hope you feel motivated and compelled to do something, recognizing that there's no such thing as a noble thought or a noble feeling. There's only and ever noble deeds. And when you do something, then you'll be able to proclaim yourself as noble. And I believe this community is noble. I know we aspire to be. And the way we'll actually prove that is when all of us get to work. The last piece that I want to touch on is the concept of mutuality. The idea that all of us have an interdependence, that we rely on one another, that frankly, we need one another. And not just simply one another to exist, but that we need one another to flourish, to do well, to be free, to be seen equal under the law and in the light of modern society so that we can benefit and understand that the systems that we've all built and constructed are genuinely fair, are actually and meaningfully set up and live and, excuse me, exist in a way that supports all of us, that supports all of our children, all of our loved ones, all of our community members. I deeply believe this, that there is something so real about this idea that I cannot be okay. I shouldn't be fully okay if you in some real measure can't be okay. So if I have to look at a young Latino boy who's 5 years old and know that by no fault of his own, the world is not going to treat him nor offer him the same capacity to pursue happiness, to make a life, to build a career, to provide for a family, then I also have to be the person that realizes, then I shouldn't be okay fully till shit like that goes away, till stuff like that starts to get corrected. And if it's not going to get corrected, then what I have to do is rebel and act and work until it does. Because one of the biggest misconceptions is that you, because you're okay, will indefinitely continue to be okay if other people aren't. And there are many examples inside human history and inside American history where you hold a group down long enough with enough dismisses, enough unheard cries, enough unanswered calls for help, and all of a sudden that particular group, they're going to revolt. That's in fact how this country got started. Because there was a number of people who felt unheard and decided that they were not free and that the systems in power would not honor their notion of freedom and equality. And so they left and built a nation. Many wars were fought this way here. And I don't think any of us have any interest in that. I think what we have a genuine interest in is progress, is a future where everybody is genuinely at a place where they have the same chances. Now, not everybody has the same talents. And we happen to live in a world and in a capitalist country where the market is going to appreciate certain things more, whether those things are more valuable or not. I think it's obvious certain things are more valuable. I'm going to say that a teacher is a deeply necessary and valuable thing, and this country's not going to reward teachers. It's problematic. It is going to reward entertainers, right? It's not even going to reward doctors like it used to. We're starting to shift into a place where we've stopped supporting and seeing the need for these mutual wellnesses that you need your teachers to do well because they're going to educate your future generation. You need doctors to do well so they can meaningfully provide medicine. You need your workers to do well because they're the ones that undergird the entire economic system. And because we've so grown to a place where not only are those systems at play, but then we add the whole other element of, now add on to it some color, now add on to it a different gender, a different sexual orientation, and now you have a real uphill fight. And for those communities, for Black communities, for BIPOC communities, for the LGBT community, this is a truly Sisyphean notion. We continue to push the stone uphill. We continue to hope that one day the stone will roll over. And every day and every year and every generation, the powers that be remind you that you can't push the stone over. And it's not because we're not strong. It's not because we haven't tried. It's because there's no sense of mutuality. Because if you saw me as distinctly tied to you, tied to your welfare, tied to your children's welfare, you'd help me push the stone over. If you don't, if that's not within you, then you have to be honest that the only person you really give a shit about is yourself. And the problem is, there's a lot of those people in the world. And we ain't gonna beat them because we have the best argument. We've had some good arguments for a time. It's not gonna win because we're the most attractive. We put the most resources behind it. We have the coolest style. Black style's been fucking cool for I don't know how long, right? But the thing is it doesn't seem to change. And you know why? Because you still see it as separate from you. You still see me as different from you. You see me as something other. And so when I come to you and I say, I'm in a tight spot, it's really hard. There's no impetus to do anything different that would ultimately move us toward a shared interest in moving culture forward. An example I give is like, think about it like a seven-year-old. If a seven-year-old child ran up to you and said, I'm in real trouble and I really need your help, would you sit there and go, well, I don't know, man. I'm not sure you're telling me the honest truth. I'm not sure that your story checks out. I don't really know you. It doesn't really affect me. Nope. I think most human beings would go, you know, I'm going to just assume that this seven-year-old, when he tells me he's in a real pickle, is probably telling me the truth. And then we're going to get to work, and you're going to solve that problem. And somewhere between a seven-year-old Black boy and a 34-year-old Black man, that ability to see yourself as tied to that person dies. I don't know when it happens, but it does. And so that means that for the inevitable future, as long as people see themselves as islands, as long as you and this community sees themselves as separate from communities of color, communities of poverty, communities of alternate genders or sexualities, different socioeconomic statuses, shit will never change. My hope is that at the start of this series is the start of something real, where people begin to humble themselves to a place where they could really hear, much like you would a seven-year-old, those real cries for help, those real cries of pain, of disenfranchisement, of fear, of worry, that you would all of a sudden grow to a place where you could embody what you come to believe about those stories, about these people you connect with, that you find a way to actually live out the thing that you think is true, that you think is real, that you think will make a change in the world, that you show up with your body, with your actions, with your money, with your intellect, with your influence, and you do something different. And lastly, that you do so out of a sense of mutuality, recognizing that you won't be good if I'm not good. Long term, your children won't be good. Those wealthy won't be good without those poor. Those sick won't be good without those well. Those free won't be good without those in bondage. You will need everyone to show up. You will need everyone to arrive. You will, much like Ram Dass says, you will have to walk one another home in the true hope that as we build and reconcile and endorse and love and protect this human family, we all grow more interconnected, more aware of the needs and the hopes and the desires of one another, and we work as an actual unit to bring that about. Justice, freedom, love, opportunity, these things are not material. They're not fancy clothes and big homes and stupid shit that no one's going to remember when they die. These are the things that will doom a life, that harm families, that break communities in half, and absolutely shatter nations. And they have since the dawn of mankind. And our job is to be the insurgents, to be the revolutionaries, not only in idea, not only in feeling, but most importantly, in deed, in what we actually do. So I hope as you engage in this series for the next coming weeks, I hope you listen, I hope you learn, but man, dude, most importantly, I just hope you get to fucking work. I hope you work. I hope you realize that that's how it's gonna change. In your little sphere, in your little world, in your office that you work in, and the people you know on social media, and your families, that you get to work, that you fight on our behalf. There's not many of us, there's not enough of us. We're gonna need you, you're gonna have to play the game. And when you get tired, and when you grow fatigued, you just remember that we've all been there for a very long time, generationally. Welcome to the club. And that we are glad to have you, and this work is super hard, but you are equipped to do it. We have done it before. We have done it for so many groups of people, and we will have to keep doing it. This is the work. This is the divine work. And I'm really excited to be a part of this community. I'm excited that you're here to do this and walk this journey with us. And I hope you'll stay through the whole thing. And I really do hope that you, as an individual, will do the things you need to do to bring about the change that you can manifest. So thank you for your time. I'll see you soon. Thank you, everyone, for listening to my talk. And I certainly hope that it impacted you and moves you, most importantly, to action. Over the next few weeks, you're going to be hearing from a number of different speakers, and I'm sure they'll have different action steps for you to take. And so I want to at least just mention the three big ones for me that I think are incredible places to start and supremely useful for people wherever they find themselves on this journey toward racial equity, awareness, and actual action. So the three names are Rachel Cargill, Ibram Kendi, and Leila Saad. Leila Saad wrote a book called Me and White Supremacy, and it's a 28-day journey, a thing that once a day you read a part of her book and it gives you practical things to do to engage in and to grow in greater awareness and action toward this particular end. Ibram Kendi wrote a book called How to Be an Anti-Racist, which is about the basic awareness that there is no such thing as kind of in the middle on this issue, that actually being not racist is not enough, that in fact we have to actively work against it. And in his book, he lays out quite specifically what that looks like in the modern era for a white person seeking to be an ally. And lastly, Rachel Cargill has been someone that has exploded onto the scene as probably the most prominent voice in the social media world, but also in terms of creating resources. She has two. One's called #DoTheWork, and it's a free 30-day kind of experience where she introduces you to new resources and steps you can take. And then the second one is called The Great Unlearn, which is another process too. All of these things, all of these educators have made very clear practical steps that you can take to become a better ally, or as Leila Saad says, a better ancestor to Black people and people of color in this world. I hope you will do this. I hope you will understand that it is this work that really aligns you with us. It's this work which really works to change the social world and our reality as people of color within it. So I hope you take a look, check it out, share it with your people and your community. And thanks again for hanging with me today.